I get some books and bring them home and just spend all of my time reading. Then when we moved my third through high school years, we moved to the other side of town, and I soon discovered the library there. This one was one of those old mansions that they had remodeled into a library, and it had two floors, and it was surrounded by this black iron fence, and it had a Shakespeare garden, and had a fireplace, yeah. And then it was full of all these books again. And that became my new hangout. And those two libraries were probably the most influential thing that I remember in my life in terms of influencing me. When I went into, when I was in high school then, I had already decided that when I grew up, I was going to be a librarian. Okay, I decided that long ago. There was no other choice. Never was any other choice in my life. And when I got into high school, then I was on the library club, and I worked as a volunteer in the library, and I became good friends with the librarian, whose name I can't remember right now. So I asked her what I had to do to be a librarian. And I realize now that this was one of those communication misunderstandings that influenced my whole life, because like everybody else, I thought that anyone who worked in a library was a librarian. What I was asking her really is, what do I have to do to get a job in a library when I graduate from high school? She took me literally, and she thought I wanted to become a professional librarian. So she answered me and said I had to go to college, and I had to get a master's degree in library science. I realized afterwards that I thought, okay, if I wanted to work in a library, that was my only option.
I see.
So I went home and told my parents, I have to go to college. This sort of shocked them, because no one in either my mother's family or my father's family had ever been to college or thought about going to college. But I explained to them that this was the only way I could be a librarian, so they decided, well, okay, they would help me go through college. So I went to college, got my master's degree, and somewhere along the way, I discovered that indeed you could work in a library without being a professional librarian, but by then it was too late.
You already were one.
I was on my way and wasn't about to turn back.
So you went to school in Green Bay, at UW-Green Bay first?
Yes. It was not UW-Green Bay at the time. It was the University Extension in Green Bay. Primarily, I did that for financial reasons. My parents really had to work, and at that time, you didn't work your way through college as you do now. Yeah. Your parents paid your way, you know, and they really had a difficult time in terms of finding funding to help me. So we agreed that the first 2 years I'd go to the extension in Green Bay, which in retrospect was just an absolutely wonderful experience. It was in a World War II Quonset hut.
Oh, gosh.
Right next to East High School in Green Bay. And there was a small administrative office, a very tiny library. There was a biology lab and three small classrooms in this Quonset hut. And then the teachers were either part-time teachers, or they would come from Madison to teach us, or they would teach at another extension. And they all had just one big room with a desk apiece in the room, all crammed in there. You could barely walk between the desks, okay? And then the only other thing in the Quonset hut was like the student lounge, they called it. And it was a big place where we could spend our time when we weren't in classes. And a half a block away, there was the little proverbial coffee shop. So we spent all our time either in the classroom, in that student lounge, or in the coffee shop. And the faculty had no place else to go either. So they spent all of their time in the classroom, in the student lounge, or in the coffee shop with us. So we had just a tremendous one-to-one contact with faculty. And I realized that, you know, it's sort of, I think, the type of experience that they're trying to do with the Bradley Center now, in terms of having faculty and students actually know each other. And a lot of the learning that went on, you know, happened outside of the classroom. Mm-hmm. The classroom was the formal lecture presentation, mm-hmm. question answer sort of stuff. But all the arguments and all of the discussions and all of the fun part happened in that student lounge and in the coffee shop. And it was just a wonderful experience. I realize mm-hmm. now, at the time I was doing it for financial reasons, mm-hmm. I didn't even realize what would happen. So I missed out completely on the freshman and sophomore experience that students were having mm-hmm. at campus, on being immersed in this large campus with huge classes, with people who were sort of impersonal lecturers standing up in front of you. By the time I came down, I was a junior.
And so what year was that that you came down?
Let's see. 62, 63.
Mm-hmm.
By then I was a junior, and so I was in the classes. I mean, there were still like, you know, 30 students to class in a class, but I missed that whole thing where you have 100 students in a class and you're...
The cattle call.
Yeah, uh-huh. It was a wonderful preparation. A very exciting, very intellectual mm-hmm. type time. I wish I could remember more of the teachers. I know that the English teacher was Bill Weaver. I had mm-hmm. a wonderful German teacher who was a German lady who was just absolutely fantastic, very warm, outgoing, wonderful person, and several other faculty on the staff who I can visualize, you know, and mm-hmm. I remember the experiences. Can't remember their names right now.
So how many students were at Green Bay at the time? Or?
Well, you know, I think there were only like a couple hundred students at the time. A lot of them were part-time students mm-hmm. because they were working full-time. And so the core of students who were there full-time during the day was a very small group. So there probably were like 30 to 40 of us maximum. That was it. That was my college class. And, you know, at least 24 of them, you know, mm-hmm. were there all day long.
Mm-hmm.
We worked together, we drank coffee together, just had a wonderful time together with the faculty.
So then was it a big change when you came down to Madison to school?
It was in a way, but I also carried with me several of the people that had gone to the extension in mm-hmm. Green Bay, so we had a natural pool when we came down. Some of my high school friends were down here, and the person that I was a roommate had gone to the extension with me as a freshman, and then came down as a sophomore, and we roomed together in the junior year. And when I came down, I was 2 years older and more mature.
Mm-hmm.
And I already knew exactly where I was going in terms of the fact that, you know, I didn't have to worry what my major was.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was going to be an English major and go on and go to library school. And so I'd really never suffered a lot of the pangs that mm-hmm. that I see freshmen in terms
yeah.
of, you know, trying to make friends, trying to blend in, trying mm-hmm. to jump from a small high school into this large college environment. Mm-hmm. I never really went through some of those problems.
But what about coming to the city of Madison versus being in Green Bay?
That really, Madison as a city really didn't impress me at the time. Mm-hmm. I was so focused on the campus and what was happening here. And I was working in the library.
Mm-hmm.
I'd gotten the library director in the Green Bay Library, I'd gotten a reference to working in the library here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was already making friends in that world.
Mm-hmm.
So I really had a very, very easy transition.
Did you have any memorable professors here once you got here?
I did take a class from Madeline Duran, who was mm-hmm. an English professor. But other than that, I really don't remember the professors that I had
mm-hmm.
during my junior and senior year on campus as much mm-hmm. as I remember the ones in my freshman and sophomore year. And then when I went on to library school, I remember some of those professors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But when you're still an undergraduate in mm-hmm. the junior or senior year, were there any organizations that you were involved in on campus or anything you can remember about what you did while you were here, or just sort of student life kind of things?
Yeah. No, I was not involved in any of the organizations. I was working at the library mm-hmm. at the time, and primarily my life was focused around that, and then just the friends, you know, mm-hmm. that I made. But I really did not get involved in any of the organizations mm-hmm. at the time. It was, we were the, what was it, the silent generation.
I see.
We were not politically active. That mm-hmm. did not come until later on in the 60s after I had graduated. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember the campus as really being a very difficult social environment, or as being an unfriendly mm-hmm. environment. And partly I think it was just because I was older mm-hmm. when I came down here. Mm-hmm. I sort of found my own little group and just lived in that world.
Yeah. Well, why don't we talk about that then? You say you spent a lot of time as an undergraduate working in the library here. Mm-hmm. And how did you... You talk on your other tape that we have in the Oral History Archives. We have another tape that Mary Tipton did for library purposes. And if anybody's interested, they can go to the Oral History Project and listen to that tape as well. But you told her about the fact that you get involved in this project, to this mammoth project that you called, to convert from Cutter classification to Library of Congress classification. Mm-hmm. I was wondering how it was that you got involved in that, and like who ran the project, and what did it entail, and that sort of thing.
Okay, well, like I said, I got the job in the library because the director of the Green Bay Public Library at the time, John Frantz, mm-hmm. knew the associate director for Memorial Library, Gerhard Nessef, mm-hmm. and he wrote a letter of reference for me in advance, and then when I came down to school, I made an appointment with Mr. Nessef, and I went in and talked to him and told him that I wanted to work in the library and that my future career plans were to be a librarian. So obviously, he was, you know, he liked me.
Yeah.
Because here I was, a real live, you know, uh-huh. potential librarian. And so he assigned me to working on this reclassification project. The library originally had used a system of classifying books called Cutter, which served its purposes quite well, but it was not being updated and maintained. So when new areas of knowledge were being introduced, there was no one who was systematically deciding where they would fit in this classification scheme. Mm-hmm. The Library of Congress had developed its own classification scheme, and all of the academic libraries at that time were switching over into that system, in part because when the Library of Congress cataloged something then, that cataloging was made available to academic libraries and they could simply copy it mm-hmm. rather than have to create their own cataloging and decide how to organize books on the shelf. So the decision had been made in this campus that the library would move to the Library of Congress classification system, and they had actually been cataloging books in that system for about a year or 2 years, mm-hmm. as I understand it, when I came down to campus. And then they started this big project to reclassify the books that were in Cutter into LC. And what I have been told is that the summer before I came down, they hired a big crew of student assistants who worked with what librarians call the shelf list. That is, for every book on the shelf, there is a card in a catalog that's arranged by that classification number so that it mimics the order of the books on the shelf. And the crew of students sat down and they used these IBM punch cards, and then they wrote one call number per book per card. And when I came in the fall, they had completed that project, and there were stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks of boxes with call numbers written on. Then that fall, they hired a group of students. I was one of them. And we took each of these cards. We found the book on the shelf. We had to count how many times it had circulated within the last 5 years and make a mark with a number 2 pencil on the IBM card. And that's what I did for a year, I think. Mm-hmm. Every day I went into the stacks and marked these cards. And we finally got through that project. And then the following summer, I was on campus. And you asked in your questions whether there was any automation involved in this. No, there was no automation involved in it. The most automated thing that we did is that after all of the cards had been marked, they were fed through a punch card reader who would scan where that number two pencil mark was and sort them so that all of the ones that had circulated 20 times were together, 19 times together, 18 times together in call number order. And my job that summer, and you know, I'm not positive, but I think it was in the basement of the physics building, there was a punch card machine. And I took all of these boxes of cards and fed them through the machine. How many reiterations until finally they were all sorted in order. That was the extent of the automation that was involved, right?
Just sort of a sorting system.
Then the following year we took the cards, and by then I was under the supervision of Milma Nesseth, Mrs. Gerhardt Nesseth. And we took the matching shuffless card that had the author entry and the title entry and all of the cards that were made. We went to the card catalog in the second floor Memorial Library, pulled out all of the cards that matched the call number. We started with the books that had circulated the most, pulled out all of the cards. That was my job, to pull cards. And then there was a group of students who used an electric eraser. This was very advanced technology. They used an electric eraser, erased the call number, the cutter call number, and then another group of student assistants typed on the new LC number, and the book was remarked and reshelved in the LC classification system.
And this is what you did the 2 years of your junior and senior year?
That's what I, in my senior year, in my junior year is when I did the marking, and in my senior year, I spent first pulling cards. I was discovered to be very good at finding elusive cards that had been misfiled. So I was given the job when they couldn't find the card that had to be pulled to go and try and find it. And then after that, I spent my time looking up call numbers in this big red set of books called LC catalog. The LC number that had to go on the cards.
That sounds like quite the undertaking. Can't imagine. I noticed they haven't got all the cutters done even.
Well, they did the ones with the highest use, and I think that when they got down to something, to the ones that had never been used or the ones that had only been used once or twice in the past 5 to 10 years, they decided that it wasn't worth the investment anymore to reclassify them in LC, and so they stopped. And they never really did complete the project, and there's no plans to complete that project
Just
now.
Leave them in cutter. Right. Well, so we sort of know why you went to library school. You would determine this when you were in high school.
Yes, so and my experience as an undergraduate, marking those cards did not deter me.
So that's why you decided to go to library school. You were determined on it long before. You didn't have any thoughts about going to any other sort of graduate school or...
No, that's where I wanted to go.
So what was life like in the library school when you went to library school?
Well, the library school was very conveniently located at that time where the Humanities Building is now.
Okay, so right on Park Street.
Right behind the University Club.
Oh, okay.
Okay. There was a former sorority house that had been converted into the library school. I seem to have a passion for places that were old houses, I don't know. So it was very easy to work at Memorial Library and just run across the street to the library school at that time. The library school was very, very small. There were perhaps a half a dozen faculty, if that. I don't remember the names of all of them. I remember that the director was Rachel Schenck at the time. I remember my cataloging teacher was Gladys Kavanaugh, and John Bowl was on the staff. I think primarily I remember him because he continued on the staff for many years after that. He must have been a very young library educator at the time when he started working there. It was clearly designed to teach people to become librarians in public libraries. That was its real mission. And so most of the focus was on the skills that you needed to be a reference librarian in a public library, mm-hmm. or to catalog books in a public library. There was a course on library administration, but it really did not get into business management, mm-hmm. per se. It was mostly library skills that you were learning. I would not consider it a master's degree program as such, mm-hmm. in terms of the intellectual content of what we were learning. We were not learning research skills, mm-hmm. And we were not learning to apply knowledge, okay? We were learning the skills that it would take to organize a library, mm-hmm. and to answer questions at the reference desk. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The completion of the program did not require a master's thesis, mm-hmm. or even a written paper of any sort. It was a 2-hour oral question.
It was an exam, no?
Oral exam, yeah. So that was all. That was.
And it was just a year required. Of coursework.
It was just 2 semesters of coursework, mm-hmm. and then the oral exam. The oral exam was scary because, of course, there was nothing in your educational background to prepare you for oral exams. Everything, mm-hmm. was written, but it really was not that intellectually demanding either. I felt that at the time I was working at Memorial Library as a cataloger, and I felt actually what I was doing there was more intellectually demanding than what I was doing at the library school. The only fascinating thing that I remember about the reference class in library school is that the professor, Gladys Kavanaugh, did have a contact with someone who was publishing a biographical dictionary. And one of the things that we did do as part of that is we were given a list of names, and we actually did an actual research project and found, mm-hmm. out all the information that we could about that person. And then that was forwarded on. It was actually published in the dictionary. So that was fun. But other than that, it was mostly routine as far, mm-hmm. as I was concerned.
It's just a means to an end.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Beginning, yeah. through. Well, besides Gladys Kavanaugh, did you have any other professors that made an impact on you, or?
As I say, the only other one that I remember is John Bull, and I think that was, mm-hmm. primarily because he continued teaching, and I've known him, mm-hmm. since then.
Yeah.
Other than that, I really don't remember. There obviously were 2 or 3 other ones because I took classes in administration as well. Mm-hmm. But that was I don't remember.
Did everyone take the same curriculum, or could you? Or
no,
there was no specialization.
It was a very narrow curriculum. You, mm-hmm. took introductory and advanced cataloging, introductory and advanced reference, government documents, administration, and there must have been something on selection. Mm-hmm. Of materials. I do not remember that course at all.
Made a great impression, huh? Made a great impression. Well, during this time, you were the first, what you called library trainee. Mm-hmm. Could you briefly say something about that program and why it was instituted and what you got out of it, how it worked?
Okay. Surprisingly, just at that time when I was going to library school and right when I graduated, the academic libraries were expanding. This was a period in which there was funding available for libraries, and right after World War II, and then particularly during this period in the early 60s, the great research libraries were putting money into developing their collections, and, mm-hmm. in the 60s, there was still a lot of money available for out-of-print buying and for creating the comprehensive collection and creating unique collections of materials around the world. And in the late 50s and the early 60s, during that expansion period, there simply were not enough people graduating from library schools who wanted to become academic librarians in order to fill the positions that were being created. Mm-hmm. So as a librarian coming out, you really had a choice of where you wanted to go, what you wanted to do. It was not the type of market it is now when you graduate from library school where, you know, you really, really feel glad if you can get a job offer from anywhere, you don't care where, you know. So one of the things that the administration at Memorial Library decided to do was to try to recruit people into the profession mm-hmm. by offering these half-time positions so that you could support yourself while you were going to library school. And since I had been on the staff and I had worked with Mrs. Nesseth, who was married to Mr. Nesseth, who was the associate director, and I had done a lot of these special projects, I was known to the people on the staff. They knew that I was going on to library school, so they offered me this first position, this first trainee position, and used me as a way to get permission from the civil service administration on campus to create these trainee positions. On my part, it was very, very helpful because I was being paid at a just under a librarian one level. I did go back and look in my documentation, and I found it fascinating because as a half-time person during that year, my salary was just under $2,500. And when I graduated from library school and became a real librarian, my salary was $5,000. And I can't imagine living on that small amount of money at that time, but it obviously was adequate. Mm-hmm. So I found it very useful because it did mean that I could get off from my parents' support mm-hmm. and I could start supporting myself, and that was adequate to support myself and go to library school at the time. It also meant that I was doing real live library cataloging at the library at the time, and I was being trained by a cataloger, Edmund Chobilski. I was cataloging microforms, so I was doing monographic as well as serials cataloging and learning all the ins and outs about cataloging at the time.
I think we're just about out of tape on this one, so we should probably stop and then just flip it over and we'll begin again.
Okay.
Okay, the tape is back on.
Okay, the other thing that was useful, of course, as I said, was that Memorial Library was right across the street from mm-hmm. the library school. And because I was in the cataloging department, they could be very flexible in terms of when I would work. So I could work and then, you know, 10 minutes before class, run across the street, take class, and then mm-hmm. run back to work again. So mm-hmm. it worked out quite well for me. And I was really glad to have the opportunity to do mm-hmm. that.
While you were in library
school. While I was in library school.
Mm-hmm. Well, once you did finish library school, why did you remain here in Madison if the job market was like the way you said it was?
Well, the summer before, I had met my future husband.
I see.
And we had made plans that we would be married that June mm-hmm. When he graduated from college and I got my master's degree. And so we went out job hunting, and quite literally at that time, I felt that wherever he got a job, I would be able to walk into the community and say, here I am, I'm a librarian, and they would say, which job do you want, and can you start today?
It
really was wide open. Yes, indeed, it really was. So he interviewed in various places, but ended up working at the Veterans Administration hospital on right on from campus here. Mm-hmm. And so I told the people at Memorial Library that they had lucked out and that I was going to stay. And they were very, very, very happy to hire me as a cataloger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so your first job was as a cataloger. Mm-hmm. Just briefly, how was cataloging done then compared to how it would be done today in 1996? I mean, what is the difference of...
Well, of course, this was pre-automation, mm-hmm. and so everything was done manually. And as I said before, we were still at that time buying a lot of out-of-print books, mm-hmm. buying a lot of unique materials. The Library of Congress did have that program at the time that if they cataloged something, the library would get, we purchased a copy of a catalog card that we could use to catalog our own materials. But we still had to do a lot of cataloging ourselves, original cataloging, and actually take the book and create the records. They were all typed in typewriters. And then we had a duplicating machine that would make multiple copies of the card, and then they had to be put in a typewriter, and the author's name or the title or the subject heading, whatever you were going to file the card under, was typed on the top of the card, and then they were manually filed into the catalog. So it was a both an intellectual process in terms of describing the book mm-hmm. and deciding where it would fit into the classification and the subject headings you were signing, but it was also a very clerical process in that the cards had to be handled manually and alphabetized manually and mm-hmm. and filed manually and revised, and any time you wanted to make a change, you had to use that electric eraser and mm-hmm. type over the top of it. So it was a quite different operation at the time. Required more staff than we mm-hmm. have now.
More clerical staff.
Required a fair number of clerical staff as well as people who were doing the actual cataloging.
Whereas today, how many would just the cataloger be doing the job? Sort of just entering the data, and there would be no need for clerical staff?
Well, nowadays there's very little original cataloging being done. Mm-hmm. We've had a few projects in recent years in which we have cataloged special collections that we've gotten grant money to catalog. For example, there's a pharmacy collection mm-hmm. that is used worldwide as a historical pharmacy collection. We got money to catalog that, and we did original cataloging for that. But nowadays, most cataloging is done by sitting at a computer screen, linking into the OCLC, mm-hmm. the Online Catalog Library Center, mm-hmm. Searching, finding the cataloging copy for whatever it is that you want, verifying it, and it's sent electronically to our catalog and it's entered. does not require professional librarians to do it anymore. Requires professional librarians to supervise, to train people in terms of being sure that it's a quality record and accurate, but does not require professional staff to actually do the work anymore. We hire paraprofessional staff to do it.
Very different, though. But then in 1967, you get your first supervisory job. You became the head of Germanic cataloging. What did that entail, being head of Germanic cataloging?
It was more of the same. Instead of actually doing, well, I still continue to do some cataloging myself, but instead of actually doing the cataloging, I was supervising people who were doing original cataloging in the Germanic languages. By that time, we were in despair of getting enough people who graduated from library school who could read Germanic languages to do the original cataloging that needed to be done. So we hired people who had the language background and were interested and willing to learn how to catalog books. And so my job as the head of Germanic cataloging was to teach them cataloging skills. They had the language skills. And
make
so
librarians
then,
out of them.
Right. Well, we didn't actually make librarians out of them, but
we
definitely made catalogers out of them. And that was the only way that we could get the books cataloged at that time. So I supervised, I don't know, between 4 and 6 people who were doing that, and I had to train them and then revise the work that they were doing, sometimes in languages that I couldn't read, so.
Hard to trust them.
Yes, indeed.
That's what it says in Danish. And you worked there for about 3 or 4 years, and in 1970 you became head of processing for the whole, was that for the whole general library system or just for Memorial?
Well, the cataloging that was done throughout my career was done for the general library system, including the branch libraries, as they were called at that time. The Health Sciences Library, Engineering, the Steinbach Library, Law, IMC, were all independent libraries and did their own cataloging. So it was primarily Memorial Library and then the smaller branch libraries. Business was an independent library at that time, was not part of the Memorial Library system and was integrated later on. Social Work Library and Social Sciences Library were integrated later on. So there were a handful of libraries. Geography, Geology were one library. There was a Math Library, a Chemistry Library, a Physics Library. A pharmacy library. That was probably it. So we were cataloging for Memorial and that handful of small branch libraries at the time.
So what did it entail doing at Memorial? What were your new job responsibilities as head of processing?
In the processing department, this was the brainchild of Frank Bright, who was the associate director at that time and in charge of technical services. He felt that it would be more efficient if he took the searching that was done for new acquisitions in the acquisitions department that ordered and paid for the books, and the searching that was done in the catalog department to identify cataloging copy for the books that they came in, and combined it into one department. He thought that there would be less duplication of work. So he created that department, and Andrea Connors was the first head of the department. She was there for about a year, year and a half, 2 years, something like that, and then she left. As I said, at that time we were still in the having difficulty finding librarians to hire in academic librarians, particularly librarians at that point with experience. My whole career, I've just been, you know, one bit ahead when they needed people with experience. I was the same batch that graduated when there weren't very many librarians, so there weren't many people with experience either. So they reassigned me to be the head of the processing department. That's as much as I could say. I never applied for the job. They just said, we need someone to be the head of the processing department. You have the cataloging experience that we need. We want you to do this. And I said I wasn't very much interested. And they said, It's your duty.
I see. So how big of a department was the processing department at
Well,
the time?
Let's see. At that time, there must have been about a dozen people, maybe.
About a dozen people.
And it was all classified staff, paraprofessional staff.
And you were the only librarian.
I was the only librarian, right. And again, I my jobs were primarily training mm-hmm. new staff coming in and what they needed to do in terms of understanding libraries and how we handled the cataloging. We would get every month, every week, I think, we would get mm-hmm. batches of cards from the Library of Congress for the things that we had cataloged, and then we had to match them up with the books that we were acquiring in order to find the cataloging copy. And if we didn't find that copy, then we would search the book in other bibliographies in order to find information about it, and also try and verify the author to see if we had any other things written by the same author. If we didn't, we would try and find that crucial information about the author. When was he or she born? Did he or she die if they were dead? And pass that on to the people in the catalog department mm-hmm. then who actually created the records.
Mm-hmm. Another thing was that when you got this job, this promotion, you became an assistant professor.
Mm-hmm.
They no longer do that. They
right.
no longer make librarians assistant professors. When did this policy change? And sort of how did you feel first personally about becoming an assistant professor? How do you feel about the change in policy, good or bad or whatever?
Yeah, again, it was just one of those things that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The academic staff at that time was a new category. Most of the positions on campus were in the classified, and that created barriers in terms of recruiting and also in terms of benefits that could be offered. So the campus started experimenting with this academic classification. And I actually had been hired as a classified librarian and then moved into being an academic librarian. And then when I became a department head, I moved into being a professor simply because at the time all of the department heads in the library were at that rank.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only option to the classified at one point in time when the classified ranks, you know, there was no way to promote people and to recognize department head or associate director or director mm-hmm. status at that time except through the faculty rank. So I moved into the faculty rank. It did offer much better benefits in mm-hmm. terms of vacation, sick leave, retirement plan, and it offered job security.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, there was no job security for academic staff. Mm-hmm. It was an annual appointment.
Oh,
librarians didn't worry about it. You had to be pretty bad to be fired
uh-huh.
because of this job market that we had.
Shortage
yeah,
of
you
librarians.
Know. So it was sort of just an automatic,
mm-hmm.
As far as I was concerned. It did not change my life in any way.
Mm-hmm.
It did not make me a member of the faculty on campus.
Mm-hmm.
It did not increase my contact with faculty because I was not a member of a teaching department.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I did not really become eligible for faculty committees,
mm-hmm.
For campus-wide committees or whatever. The appointment was in the library, and the tenure was in the library, and that was the extent of it. It was a useful appointment for the bibliographers.
Mm-hmm.
Because for the bibliographers are the people who select the materials for the
mm-hmm.
library. And their appointments were joint appointments. So their tenure actually resided in the library, but they had a joint appointment with the department on campus for whom they were selecting materials. that brought them into contact with the faculty, and it gave them a sort of equal status with the faculty, so that the faculty were comfortable that there was someone with a scholarly background in the field that were selecting the materials that were going to be housed in the mm-hmm. library. So for the bibliographers, I think it was a useful development.
Mm-hmm.
For the administrators, though, it really, as far as I was concerned, didn't really change mm-hmm. anything in terms of mm-hmm. the way that we operated. The policy changed. If you look at my resume, you'll notice that I was the acting director of the college library mm-hmm. from July of 1980 to March of 1984. That's a mm-hmm. very long time to become an acting director.
Yes.
The reason I was an acting director that long is because in the 1980s, the campus decided that they did not want to continue. In late 1979 and 1980, somewhere in there, mm-hmm. the campus administration decided they did not want to continue faculty titles for librarians. The director of the libraries at the time, Joe Trays, fought it. And when the director of the college library, Dorothy Schultz, retired, they refused to allow him to fill the position as an academic position, as a faculty position. He therefore refused to fill the position until they would agree that it could be filled as a faculty position. Okay. And it was stalemate. It was standoff. The campus administration would not change, and he would not fill the position. So I was the acting director until he resigned.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the exact date, but I think somewhere like in December of 83 or mm-hmm. January of 84, somewhere in there, he resigned. And we had an acting director, Nancy Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
And Nancy Marshall said, "We've lost the battle, okay? The campus administration is not going to appoint librarians as faculty anymore. It's time that we fill this position." So they did the search and screen, and I was offered the position, and so on. April of 1984, I became the director of college library. Of course, I carried with me, because I was already tenured mm-hmm. as a faculty member, I carried that position with me, and it continues with me now. But when I retire, the next director of college library will be an academic position, as is the director of the general library system. When Kay Gapin, for example, was hired after, you know, Nancy Marshall was the acting director, mm-hmm. and then the permanent director hired was Kay Gapin. She was hired in an academic position with tenure,
mm-hmm.
and the current director is in an academic position. And bibliographers have all been appointed in academic positions. As people with faculty status retire, mm-hmm. they are replaced with people in academic positions.
So they do get professorships, or they
no.
do they mm-hmm. do just
academic
staff?
Mm-hmm, right.
Okay.
And so those of us on the staff with faculty status, as we retire, we're being phased
out. We'll be the last ones.
And right. Uh huh. So I don't know who's going to end up being the actual last one. I mentioned to you when you came in mm-hmm. that I need to leave today in order to attend Faculty Senate. Mm-hmm. With the next person who retires from the library with faculty status, I believe that we will no longer have enough librarians with faculty titles that we will be able to elect our own faculty senator. Okay.
So we have to combine
yes,
with somebody else.
I think
and
there's
elect.
Like five or six of us left.
Oh, only that many?
Mm-hmm. So we are talking now, are thinking now that perhaps we'll combine with the library school.
Mm-hmm.
So I may be the last librarian who actually is a faculty senator.
Mm-hmm. You might be one of the last. Ooh, that's historically important.
I may be the actual last one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we have a couple bibliographers who have faculty status now who have announced their retirement
mm-hmm.
Within the next year, and so I think that the next time when my term of office as a faculty senator is completed, we will not have enough people to elect a senator on our own. So I think I am the last
you
one.
You will be the last one. Unless there's somebody from the library school people decide to elect the librarian.
That's
and
right.
not one of the library
right.
professors.
But in terms of having our own district or whatever, I'll be the last one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do I feel about it? I really don't feel that it accomplished its purpose. The key thing that librarians are concerned about is that academic programs change without the involvement of the library in terms of the preparation and being able to support with the research materials the change in the program. New faculty are hired with a new area that they want to do research. And too frequently, that is not communicated to the library until after the fact. And then the new person says, well, I need all of this stuff in order to support my research. New fields of study are instituted. New programs are instituted. Like the Women's Studies program was a very major program. But there really was no planning for library resources before the actual program was instituted. There was a feeling that if librarians had faculty status and that if we moved more in faculty circles and could get on the key planning committees, that would change. It did not change in reality. It may well be that in some of the smaller campuses, like in UW-Green Bay, that is useful, and that having faculty status for librarians is useful. But it did not really serve that purpose on this campus. So I really don't feel that the title per se of faculty status was the key thing. I think that the mechanisms needed to be developed, and it doesn't matter if you're academic staff or if you're faculty, as long as those mechanisms are there. That's what the important thing is. Faculty that are trusting librarians to select have to have confidence that that person has got a PhD in that field and that they understand the field and can select in the field. And that can be achieved whether you have academic status or faculty status. So I have not felt that it's a great loss to libraries that we don't continue to have faculty status on this campus. I also feel that the role of librarians is more of an administrator than it is of a researcher, and that research in the field of librarianship has been more in terms of the automation and integrate in developing new ways to access information and to control collections. But this is not traditional research and publication in the way that it is done by faculty. And so our intellectual links are different.
So then after that, though, you in 1976, after spending 6 years in processing, and you were made associate director of college library, much to the processing department's dismay, I learned, reading through the committee minutes. How and why were you made, why was it that you were made associate director of college library?
Well, it was one of those things again. I've never applied for a job in my life other than my first student job here. Joe Trace was reorganizing. He wanted to create a oversight mechanism for the member libraries. They were still branch libraries at that time, but we call them member libraries now. The member libraries at that point all reported directly to him, as well as all of the bibliographers and all of the department heads and just about everybody in the library reported to him. And so he wanted to reorganize and have a better hierarchy and a cleaner reporting lines. He wanted Dorothy Schultz to not only be director of the college library, but also to be the supervisor of these member libraries. She in turn bargained that if that was the case, she wanted someone with administrative experience as an associate director in college library to continue to assist her in terms of running college library so that she could devote half of her time to the development of the member libraries.
I see.
So Dorothy Schultz looked around at who was available and decided that I had good administrative experience and that she would like me to transfer over to college library. So Joe Trace said he wanted me to transfer over to college library. I said, you know, that's a pretty big change because I don't know anything at all about running libraries or public services. He said, but it was still a good idea that I did that. And besides which, we were at the point of automating for the first time, bringing in OCLC to do cataloging. And he wanted to combine together the processing department that I was head of and the copy cataloging unit that Sandra Fehler was head of into one department, and that made organizational sense. And he was right. It really did make organizational sense because the handling of all of these cards and preparing the stuff for cataloging needed to be phased out since we were going to now be relying on doing this through OCLC. Computer terminals hooked up to OCLC. So he thought that this was a marvelous plan and that Sandra Fehler would be in charge of this new unit under Frank Bright and I would move over to college library. So I did it.
So you
I
moved.
Said, well, okay, if that's my duty, that's my duty, so I moved over to college library. So that's how I ended up over here without any public service experience at all. So I became a reference librarian and started learning from Dorothy Schultz how to run a library, how to run a circulation department. I didn't have any experience there. And in general, how to manage a library rather than a department, which was a quite different experience.
You had no background in this?
No background whatsoever.
Just quickly, just briefly discuss college library. Why was there a separate undergraduate library? Why did college exist?
In about 1950, I was just looking at these statistics. The number of undergraduates on this campus was about 10,000, and within the next 10 years, it had gone up to 15,000 undergraduates. And by, I have to look up my dates here.
That's okay.
But I did look this up ahead of time. Okay, yeah, by 10 years later, in 1961-62, there were about 15,000 undergraduates. 10 years after that, in 1971-72, there were over 23,000 undergraduates. So in this 20-year span of time, the number of students on campus doubled. And what that created was tremendous pressures on the facility of Memorial Library, with all of these students wanting to use it as study space, as well as on the staff at Memorial Library. The undergraduates were overwhelming the place, and faculty were complaining because there were too many undergraduates underfoot.
Okay, why don't we stop and then... Okay, we were talking about the need for college library, and you were rattling off some statistics in the last table.
All right. So as a response to that, the same thing was happening in large research institutions across the United States. In response to that, some institutions, and I think Harvard was one of the first ones that experimented, they tried creating a separate undergraduate library in order to relieve the pressure from the research library. Mm-hmm. And they were all designed very similar to the way this library is, with lots of study space, small collections, and a staff that would be interacting primarily with the undergraduates in order to lure the undergraduates away from the research library and allow the faculty and the graduate students to have the quiet research environment that they wanted. Well, that didn't actually materialize in terms of Memorial Library. Undergraduates still dominate the place, particularly at night. Mm-hmm. But that was the reason that I can't remember his first name. Kaplan.
Lou Kaplan,
yeah. Decided to create an undergraduate library. So in 1961, he asked Dorothy Schultz to start creating an undergraduate library, and it opened in the study rooms in Memorial Library.
Okay.
First on the first floor in that big study room, and then it expanded up to the second floor. And during that period of time, he lobbied with campus administration in order to get funding to build a separate undergraduate library. And he was the one that pulled in all of his political chits in order to get this library with this beautiful view over the lake.
We're looking over the lake right now.
Right, the first three floors of this building, which it's just absolutely phenomenal that he was able to do that, that the campus was willing to devote this prime real estate to undergraduates.
Yes, a side note, Donna's office is beautiful, has a wonderful view of Lake Mendota.
Lou's major premise was that the undergraduate library had to be in the heart of campus, mm-hmm. and it had to be right near the Memorial Library if they were going to attract the undergraduates here, rather than them continuing to go to Memorial Library. Building it off, you know, out by the practice fields was mm-hmm. not going to do it. It had to be in the center of campus. And so he was able to convince the administration when they were building this building to do it. So they tore down the old buildings that were on this site and created this hybrid building with the English department, the library school, and then there have been other programs that have
moved
in and out over the course of the years, and the first three floors were dedicated to this library. The library opened in 1971-72, and that fall of the year.
So it wasn't very old when you moved here as associate director.
That's right, yeah. The original plans for the library said that there would be 29 staff when this library opened. During the period in which the library was built, Lou Kaplan retired and Frank Bright became the acting director. And Lou's political influence did not carry forward. When the library was actually opened, there were two professional staff, two or three paraprofessional staff and student assistants, and a small collection and an empty building. It literally was quite an empty building at the time. So there's been a lot of growth in terms of the library since then.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Frank Bright did was to try and find other positions within the library to reallocate to the undergraduate library. And of course, that had been one of Dorothy's goals every year, was to try and beef up the staff in the library. So when Joe Trey's asked her to be head of the member libraries as well as college library, this was another way that she recruited additional staff. I was one
I
of the
see.
Additional staff that she was recruiting.
So that was the personnel situation when you got here. It was still understaffed.
It was still very understaffed, yeah. Over the course of the years, we've gradually been able to add staff to it, but we had added additional staff before then. I think there were like four or five librarians, and maybe an equal number of classified staff, and a large contingency by then of student assistants. Mm-hmm. One of the things, though, is that when the library opened, the reserve room was not part of the undergraduate library.
Oh, it wasn't?
No.
It was still a memorial.
It was housed here.
Oh.
But it was run by Reed Reddick, who was at Memorial Library, and that reserve staff was at Memorial Library. So one of the growths for the library has been the fact that over the course of the years we've taken on the reserve function, and that whole staff has been absorbed. Mm-hmm. And then we added the computer center, and we added the microcomputer center and lab, and we added staff then. Mm-hmm. So part of the reason that staff were added was because we were also adding on new functions.
When did you open up the microcomputer center here? Do you know when that was?
Let's see, that I don't remember that date offhand. I'm going to stop the tape.
Yeah.
We opened the media and the microcomputer center in the remodeled study hall here in 1989-90. Mm-hmm. The year before that, we'd had like a dozen microcomputers down in the first floor room where the ethnic studies is now. And then Kay Gapin was able to get funding for us to remodel that whole second floor. It had been just an empty study hall. Mm-hmm. And we remodeled that whole facility. And then in 89-90, we were able to open that facility.
So what would you say those were two of the bigger changes that have happened since you've been associate acting for that long time and then director, was the moving, complete moving of reserves over here, and then the opening of the microcomputer center?
And let's see, I guess a third one would be the expansion of our teaching program, our user education program. Mm-hmm. When I joined the staff, there was one librarian who was working with faculty to teach students in the classroom setting how to use library mm-hmm. resources. We now have got five or six people who are doing that, and we have an automated multimedia program to teach students, and we're part of the core requirements in the fact that the communications requirement, all of those students do have to come to the library now to learn how to use library resources. Mm-hmm. And over the course of the years, from that one librarian who was teaching until now, that's been a major program that's expanded. And then the other was the automation. I would say that those are the four major changes in the library mm-hmm. over the course of the year.
Mm-hmm. Well, one other question before we move on to the automation is I understand from my conversations with several of your colleagues that you had, for a time in the 80s, you had job responsibilities both here at college and Memorial. And what was the nature, I didn't sort of get it, what was the nature of that work arrangement that you were either acting director here or director, I didn't find out which period it was in, but during either your directorship or your acting directorship, you had split job responsibilities.
Yeah. This was after I became director. It was after Kay Gapin mm-hmm. became director of libraries. When was it? Like about 86, was it, that there was the governor's repair bill, and we had a retrenchment in the university, and we lost something like 20 positions in the general library system. And so Kay Gapin reorganize the library in order to be able to function effectively with fewer people. As part of that reorganization, she moved a lot of people around and created an advisory committee to the director of libraries. She, in my functions as director of college library, she had added me to that advisory mm-hmm. group, and it included the director of the Steenbach Library and the head of technical services, the head of public services, mm-hmm. the budget director, head of personnel.
Mm-hmm. All the different directors within the system.
And the head of automation, mm-hmm. Nolan Pope, who we had just hired, and Lou Pitchman, head of collection development, who we had just hired. So she mm-hmm. created this management group. And as part of that management group, okay, I accepted responsibilities for overall general library system planning. Mm-hmm. And so part of that, I organized a couple planning retreats for the management group. Mm-hmm. We did not a really a strategic plan, but yearly plans in which we had overall library objectives, and then the various units had unit objectives underneath the library objectives. Mm-hmm. And I sort of took administrative responsibility for making that happen, and also responsibility to be sure that it was all compiled and published and distributed, etc. Mm-hmm. And I had that for several years. And then, I'm going to turn that off. Yep. In September of 1989, our budget officer for the general library system resigned and took another job on campus. And so Kay asked me to fill in that position while we hired a new budget officer. We went through the search and screen process and we hired someone new. Kay was not an in-library type person. She was definitely an excellent person in terms of working outside of the library. Mm-hmm. She was not interested in training a new budget director. So we hired Margie Annenson. Mm-hmm. I continued to supervise Margie Annenson for a period of time. Mm-hmm. And the understanding when we did the search and screen was that I would do this for about a year, mm-hmm. and then the budget director would report to the director of libraries. So from September of 89 until December of 1990, I was in this dual mm-hmm. position. Until Margie came on board, which was in like September, October of 90, somewhere in mm-hmm. there, I was actually doing both jobs, and mm-hmm. college libraries suffered tremendously because I had no training as mm-hmm. a budget officer. And
these positions with no training.
Yes. And also, the key people, the key support people mm-hmm. in Memorial Library had all resigned. There was no one to do the work. We were on our third LTE person for payroll, which is kind of essential.
Yes.
And we had a vacant position in terms of all the business services in terms of ordering supplies mm-hmm. and things for the library, paying the bills for the library. We had a vacant position. So I had to hire someone new to do work that I didn't understand. And there were no manuals, mm-hmm. and there was nothing to go on. The person before me, we just started getting into mm-hmm. automating things, and the person before me had not like put all of this budget stuff in a spreadsheet, mm-hmm. and so there were no records other than, you know, the university mm-hmm. monthly ledger sheets that mm-hmm. come. That was the only record that we had. So I had no management data, I had no projections, I had nothing. So it was a very difficult time for the library and for college mm-hmm. library, because I had to devote 90% of my time to trying to figure out how we were going to get through this next year mm-hmm. until we hired someone. We did then hire Margie, who is an excellent person and had a lot of budget background, but no university background, mm-hmm. so she had to learn the university system. So we instituted a training program for her to learn the university system, and as I said, I had planned to supervise her for about a year, and then Kay resigned mm-hmm. Under duress, mm-hmm. and Ken Frazier was appointed acting director.
Mm-hmm. When was that exactly? I think I have the date wrong on the sheet.
I think that it was in January of 1991.
Okay, yeah.
Thereabouts, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that Kay resigned like in November of 1990 maybe, mm-hmm. and that Ken was appointed as acting director either in December or January.
Yeah, we'll get back to that anyway when we return to just talk about your dealings with the directors, but mm-hmm. just on this job.
Right. So then when Ken came on board,
mm-hmm.
it was an entirely different situation.
Mm-hmm.
And Ken was a very experienced manager mm-hmm. from his managing the Steinbach Library, mm-hmm. and he had his own budget, mm-hmm. et cetera, there. And so we all agreed that it would be best if Margie just reported directly mm-hmm. to him. So then I stepped out of the picture.
Okay.
But it was a very
trying period,
difficult period,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
for everyone that was involved in it.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna stop. We've made the decision that since we started talking about some of the directors, that maybe we would go to and talk about the different directors that Donna has worked with. Just briefly, the first director that you worked with was Lou Kaplan, and just if you could briefly sort of say what you think his strengths were, what his weaknesses were, what your relationship was with him.
Lou Kaplan was very much a hierarchy type person, so I didn't mm-hmm. have a lot of direct relationship with him because I didn't report directly mm-hmm. to him. He worked primarily with Frank Bright and Joe Trays and the people that reported mm-hmm. directly to him. And during that period, I reported to Frank Bright. I would say that Lou's real strength was that he was a real book person,
mm-hmm.
and he was a scholar in his own uh-huh. right. And his number one priority was to get the books here. Whether they were cataloged, what happened to them afterwards, all of his resources were to get the books here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in retrospect, he did not put a lot of money into staff, but the books are here.
Yeah.
And that is what makes our
great
library
collection.
Great, uh-huh, mm-hmm. is the fact that we have the books. And some of the books still aren't fully cataloged, mm-hmm. but they're still here for scholars to use
if
they
them.
Need them. Uh-huh. So that was his major strength. His
mm-hmm.
major weakness was simply the fact that he was a product of his times.
Mm-hmm.
And in that time, managers were these remote, isolated people, and the human interactions, the participatory management, I don't think that word had been invented then yet, you know, and he was definitely hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
As a department head, every once in a while, Lou would decide that he did want input from his department heads, and so he would call a meeting of the department heads. We would get together. It was a very straightforward agenda. This is the subject to be discussed. What do you think? Okay, I've heard your opinions. Here's what I've decided. You know, there weren't any committees. There wasn't a lot of participatory management. So he was regarded as a very remote and unsympathetic
mm-hmm.
Person by his staff. After he retired, when I got to know Lou on a different level, he was a very, very charming, wonderful, delightful person, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But in the library, he was this mold, you know,
uh-huh.
the three-breasted suit type mold of the time.
Of his time.
Uh-huh. But I think that it is because of him that we do have this famous research
mm-hmm.
renowned library. You know, it was his strengths that managed to find the resources in order to create the collections that we have.
Mm-hmm. And his successor was Joseph Trays. And what impressions did people have of him, and sort of what were the same sort of take? What were his sort of strengths, and how well did you know him, and all that sort of?
Joe came in with the opposite management style than of Lou Kaplan. Okay,
mm-hmm.
and it was under Joe that people were regarded, the staff was regarded as really important,
mm-hmm.
and the service aspect of libraries. Up until then, yes, you were allowed to use the collection if you could figure out how to do it yourself. You know, you had to be a researcher and a scholar.
Mm-hmm.
Under Joe is when our libraries developed the service the outreach. Yes, we're reference people, and we're here to help you find what you want. Yes, we're user education people, and we will teach you how to use these resources. And he did a wonderful job of adding staff to the member libraries and of making them an integral part of the library system rather than as remote reading rooms mm-hmm. from Memorial Library. That was his real strength. And under him, people started working together. We created the committee structure and that sort of thing, but mm-hmm. people started planning together. And the direction that the library was going was more a part of joint efforts among the library staff rather than the director and two or three associate directors. Mm-hmm. That was his key strength. He was a very, very charming person as well. And I think that if you talk with other people like Sandy Fahler, you might get more insights mm-hmm. into what his problems were mm-hmm. in the last few years of his career. Because obviously something changed, and I'm not really aware of them, but his greatest strength then became his weakness. And he lost the capacity to lead.
Mm-hmm.
Not only to make decisions, but to lead others in making the decisions. His strength was bringing people together and leading them in making those mm-hmm. decisions. And then for some reason, he lost that capacity. And so he resigned under duress,
mm-hmm.
which was a shame because he really did move us into a whole new era in terms of the service aspect. That mm-hmm. that was his real legacy.
That's really
from the library.
Where he wanted to take the library mm-hmm. was more public
right.
service.
Yes, and we changed our dramatically mm-hmm. under his leadership mm-hmm. during those first few years.
And then when Joe Trays left, there was an interim, you said there was an acting director, Nancy mm-hmm. Marshall, and then she was replaced by a permanent director, Kate Gapin. What were Nancy Marshall's strengths or weaknesses, or was she all that, or do you think she was all that important to what happened in the library? And then Kate Gapin, what were her strengths and weaknesses?
Yeah. Nancy was an acting director, and she was here for just a very short period of
mm-hmm.
time. I think that Nancy did apply to become director of the library, and I think that she would have been an excellent director.
Mm-hmm.
She went to William & Mary and has done a remarkable job there and has been a continuing leader in our profession.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed working for her, and I became director of College Library under her, so I'm grateful for that as well. But she was an excellent person.
Mm-hmm.
Kay Gapin, I think, was hired because of her interest and background in automation.
Mm-hmm.
And we had started the Library Automation Project,
mm-hmm.
NLS, under Joe Trays, and needed to continue that project. Nancy Marshalls had been in Wills and then had worked for Joe Trays as associate director, but didn't have that strong library automation background
mm-hmm.
that Kay Gapin had. Kay Gapin had worked at OCLC and then had moved on to Iowa and had done library automation there, and then had moved on to Georgia, I think it was, and done a library automation project down there. Had extensive background,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's what campus was looking at, as someone that could continue that project.
Mm-hmm.
Kay's vision was library automation, and she made it happen on this campus, and not only the mainframe and the library catalog and
mm-hmm.
circulation, et cetera, but also introducing the microcomputers and the use of computers for library management type
mm-hmm.
work. That was her strength. That was her vision, and that was her strength. It was also her weakness in that she was always way out in front of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And always pushing the limits to the extent that people became disenchanted with it because it was too visionary, and there wasn't, in their mind, enough practical underlying in the directions that she wanted to go. But when I look back, her vision is where we're at today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it took us longer to get there than she would have wanted us to. But her vision was an accurate one. Where we're at today is where she wanted us to be.
Mm-hmm.
The circumstances surrounding her departure are very unfortunate in my mind. I have never been able to sort them out.
Mm-hmm.
She was accused of dishonesty, of stealing money.
Mm-hmm.
Some people on the staff believed it. Mounted a vendetta against her.
Mm-hmm.
It made its way into the newspapers and became a scandal. And the chancellor decided that she needed to move beyond that. There was no way to reconcile it. And so Kay also resigned under duress.
Mm-hmm.
I have never in my mind been able to ascertain any of the truthfulness of the charges.
Mm-hmm.
I have a continuing nagging suspicions, but I've never been able to decide one way or the other just where truth lay in that matter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was a very, very unhappy experience.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ken, came out of the Steenbach Library
mm-hmm.
and really did not have that many years of experience when he became director of the General Library System. I think he'd only been at Steenbach for a couple years.
Mm-hmm.
That was a matter of concern, I think, to a lot of people on the staff, but Ken showed the capacity to mature very, very quickly. And I think he has brought about the healing process. When he became acting director, the morale in the library was extremely, extremely low.
Mm-hmm.
It was in sub-basement levels, it really mm-hmm. was. I think that the morale in the library now is very optimistic, positive.
Mm-hmm.
Not that everyone is Pollyanna happy.
No.
In organizations that is never the case.
Clearly
but
not.
People, Ken is a very practical person,
mm-hmm.
and the first thing that he did in when he came in was said, these are practical things that we can do. We can take these small steps to make changes in the library.
Mm-hmm.
He took those small steps and promised nothing beyond that. And I think that gradually over the course of time, with a lot of participation on library mm-hmm. staff, we've taken small steps and we have progressed in a stable environment
mm-hmm.
in which people felt comfortable that the changes that are coming about were manageable and that there's no reactionary, visionary things out there,
mm-hmm.
okay, that yes, as the library world changes and as automation changes and as budget pictures change,
yeah.
we will change too, but we will do it gradually.
Mm-hmm.
And so people, I feel, have a very stable foundation
mm-hmm.
and look forward to changes. We're about to embark on replacing the current automation
mm-hmm.
system that we'll be talking about. We're
yeah.
writing RFPs for a mm-hmm. new system. But I see no fear
mm-hmm.
with this future. That the changes that we're making
mm-hmm.
in the library staff. Everyone feels this is a natural progression and that we will be in control of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking forward to it. They've decided they've outgrown notice, they want to move on to something
uh-huh.
else, and they're ready to do
right.
it. And this is, I think, greatly due to Ken's character and to the way that he has handled the library in the past few years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's been an excellent director for us. It was a very good choice.
I think we'll end on that note.